Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Dalglish. I'm a professor of oncology at St George's, a consultant medical oncologist. And I have sarcoma. I'm Angus Dalglish. I'm a professor of oncology at St George's, a consultant medical oncologist. And I have started to notice that several of my patients have melanoma who've been stable with stage 4 disease. They've had very good immunotherapy or other treatments, and I've been reviewing them from 5 to 20 years. I've noticed that I have now over 6, possibly 7, even an 8th yesterday, who've clearly relapsed following the booster vaccine. At first, we didn't put the two together. But when patients said, I felt awful since the vaccine, I've just been drained, they described symptoms of like a long COVID. And the next thing we know, 2-3 weeks, a couple of months later, they've got clear evidence of relapse. And these relapses are quite aggressive. They're not a gentle relapse. They're relapses that are requiring systemic therapy as opposed to a little nodule that requires surgical excision. But it's not just this. I'm now very much aware in my own circle of many people who are having, they haven't got melanoma, but they've never had anything before, but they've got lumps and bumps and they're not feeling well. And two people I've interviewed at great length, they all put it down to feeling awful after their booster. They were fine with the first two vaccines, or just had shivers, flu, etc. But they've described being very tired, very fatigued, wanted to stay in bed. And this has dragged on to the point where they've gone to the doctor and they've had blood counts and investigations. And I now know 7 of them. 2 of them have leukemias and the others have lymphomas. And one of them has a very bad myeloma, which he was absolutely sure was instigated by the booster as he developed the dreadful symptoms. So I want to bring to everybody's attention that I think that this does not look like a coincidence to me. And we need to join forces and see if this is a real effect. And if it is, we must stop all the boosters immediately. Thank you.
Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton, Creative Director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals and their supporters. And have we ever got a program, an important program for you tonight? We just showed you the magnificently and expensively produced Pfizer Super Bowl commercial that aims to tell you that Pfizer, who brought you one of the so-called vaccines for COVID, is the epitome of science with great work coming up to defeat cancer. The second video was from a renowned expert oncologist from the United Kingdom, Dr. Angus Dalglish, who has been reporting to the British public on the explosion of new cancers in younger and younger people that he's seen in patients since the COVID boosters were pushed on their population, as well as the health issues that he's seen since the first COVID vaccines were required. Our Dr. Corey first met Angus known as Gus Dalgleish, when both of them were testifying in the British Parliament, to the British Parliament. You're going to meet him here in just a moment. But because of the time difference, our doctors Merrick and Corey interviewed this top oncologist earlier today. You'll see the video and you're going to learn why we are thrilled that Dr. Dalgleish is going to become a collaborator in the new FLCCC cancer study. Now, as always, our nurses are already online to answer questions that you type into the Q&A here or on Rumble or wherever you're watching us. We're even taking some questions from our new FLCCC forum. I'll be back live with some of those questions for Pierre and Paul, who are here live. Gentlemen, come on, hop, come on out here. You know, this is an amazing interview that you did. Talk about a great doctor and, you know, another oncologist like Dr. Ruddy, who is not afraid to speak what he knows to be the scientific truth, like you guys do.
Yeah, thanks, Betsy. So Angus is world-renowned, actually. He has an enormous reputation. He did his training in Australia as an oncologist and then moved to the UK. He's done a lot of research, particularly with regards to HIV. And in fact, he discovered the CD4 receptor for HIV. So he's done a lot of very, you know, basic research, as well as being a renowned oncologist. So
he also knows a lot about vaccines because he tried to develop cancer vaccines, right?
Yeah.
He's so deep. Yeah.
So we did this interview today, which I think, you know, the focus was really on turbo cancer. So, you know, we're going to roll that really interesting interview, and then we can take some questions afterwards. Angus, maybe you can, for the people who don't understand, that there are a whole host of viruses that have been associated with cancer. So briefly, could you just tell us which those viruses are?
Yes, I certainly can. I've written books and chapters on this. It's amazing how many viruses do cause cancer in humans. And when I started off to go and do my MD on viruses and cancer, I was told that there was none in humans. It was once again something that only occurred in mice and lots of mouse models and animal models. Well, first of all, there was the retroviruses, and lots of retroviruses cause all sorts of tumours in mice, but we do have one, and that's the HTLV-1, the one I was going to look to try and find the receptor on. It causes leukemia and lymphoma, but only in about 1% of those people who are infected, and then only after 2 or 3 decades of infection. And this is a very, very constant theme with viruses and cancer in humans. The next big one that was identified was HBV, which is hepatitis B virus, which is a great big DNA virus, which interestingly looks like it's evolved from two complementing retroviruses, having formed a double DNA loop. Well, once again, you have to be infected with this virus for many years. It needs to cause a hepatitis, a chronic hepatitis, cirrhotic type picture before a hepatoma, the cancer, evolves. That can take 40 years. And what's fascinating, hepatitis C virus can cause exactly the same pathology, even though it's an RNA virus. Hmm. Yet the pathogenesis is the same. It takes decades and you get a liver cancer. And then, of course, then there's the human papilloma viruses, which Zurhausen was famous for, and causing cervical cancer. But we now know that those viruses are present in all the aerodigestive tract cancers as well. 50% of mouth cancers have the HPV. A large number of the esophagus, lower esophagus and lung and bronchi have HPV in them, suggesting that it's been part, that's part of the carcinogenesis exposure. And then the other big virus associated with tumors is Epstein-Barr virus, which is a great big herpes virus. And it was interestingly discovered as causing lymphomas in Africa. And this is the great secret of viruses causing cancer. You need something else, and you need quite a lot of time, usually. Well, it was presented and was found from Burkitt's lymphoma. Dennis Burkitt discovered these lymphomas in the children, and it was thought that it was infectious. There was an infectious cause. And a chap called Tony Epstein, who actually died last week at the age of 102.
Oh, wow.
He was looking for viruses that cause cancer, and he used to get samples from Dennis Burkitt in Uganda and then mash them up and try and find a virus. It's a very interesting story, because he'd arrive with the plane from Uganda and then rush and try and cultivate these viruses, and nothing happened. He couldn't, because it's a very difficult virus to cultivate. And once the plane got diverted and he didn't get it for a day late, by which time the samples are horrible and mushy. And he said, well, let's culture them nevertheless. And that's when they first saw this herpes virus known as Epstein-Barr virus. Barr was his associate. Now, we've probably all got Epstein-Barr virus. We're probably all infected with it. So why do only some people get the get tumours? Does it go on to induce tumours? Well, in the case of the Burkitt's tumour that children in Uganda get, they only get it if they've got malaria. So that is the prime. It causes the activation in the system that allows the virus to insert and induce carcinogenesis. There is a rare throat cancer in China, and once again, there is a cofactor, and this is thought to be smoked fish, and it's only in the regions where they have this smoking process for fish that you get this nasopharyngeal tumor, but it's always induced by Epstein-Barr. And of course, in HIV, Epstein-Barr virus caused nearly all the lymphomas, because HIV provided the chronic immune activation and the selective immune deficiency that goes along with that. So that's why nearly all the lymphomas in HIV were EBV positive. Interestingly, in non-EBV, it's only about half of them. And I've been part of a hunt looking for other viruses. There are probably several other that can do it in a certain appropriate scenario.
So could I ask you, so we obviously know HIV patients are at increased risk. You mentioned EBV, but these patients are also lymphopenic. Their CD4 counts are low. Mm-hmm. And so this may become relevant to what we're going to talk about next. So yes. How important do you think the CD4 lymphopenia is, and the impairment of immune surveillance is in causing the cancer in HIV?
Oh, I think it's very, very important indeed. Yes, I mean, that's why they're like everybody. The EBV sit in there, and it's very well contained. EBV affected cell, it goes to ground, so it can't be seen. And if it is seen, it's controlled by the CD4 counts. If those guys disappear, then as the cells replicate, various antigens are exposed, and if there's no CD4 to guide their control, then they go on to the next process to induce what we now know is a multi-step process of carcinogenesis, or lymphogenesis, a lymphomagenesis in this case.
So change direction a little bit? I know you've spoken about turbo cancers, so maybe you can tell us what you think, because, you know, many people think that, you know, turbo cancers following the vaccine is a conspiracy that's been contrived by anti-vax people. But, you know, we believe it's a real entity. And so are you seeing a big uptake in cancers post-vaccination?
Well, that's what I was got involved mainly for, was I actually tried to publish saying that what I'm seeing is a relapse in cancers, first of all. And I did melanoma, and I was seeing patients who'd been cured with the immunotherapy, 5, 10, 18 was the longest, completely stable, and then they have the first relapse after the booster. Not after the first two, but after the booster. And I became immediately suspicious, because that in my cancer vaccine research, we'd come across a model where as one vaccine is good, the second only useful really if the first one was a bit weak, but the third one interferes with the benefit of the first two. The fourth one completely wipes out any benefit and encourages any disease that's pre-existing. And of course, this model jumped into my head when I started to see the relapse with the booster vaccine. And then I realized that the other thing, adage that I'd learned, because I've been researching cancer vaccines for nearly three decades, and I've learned an awful lot from this. The first thing I've learned is the most important thing to induce is a good, strong, innate cell-mediated T-cell response, because without that, you lose control. So that's what I was looking for. And what we noticed was if you have a very strong vaccine that induces an inflammatory antibody response, it interferes with that T-cell control and starts to suppress it. That's what we had seen from our model, and that's what immediately came to mind when I started to see these patients relapse. Well, we now know there's papers out there showing that after the booster, the T-cells are suppressed in cancer patients. Not all of them, some of them, enough to cause this problem. Indeed, one of the papers really appropriately calls it T-cell exhaustion. I mean, the T-cells, just those that are there, just non-functional. So I think that was clever, and it goes side by side with the IgG switch that occurs after the booster, where you no longer produce IgG 1 and 3, it switches to IgG 4, which is what you want if you've got a transplant on board. So if you've got tolerization and no T cells, any cancer that's there being controlled by your innate immunity is going to pop out. Now, I mentioned I saw it in melanoma, a core patient of mine, who was actually one of my best friends. I'd been skiing with him every year for 30 years. He'd only had the booster because his wife wanted to go traveling to celebrate her 70th birthday. And they were told by all the travel companies, if she didn't have the booster and he didn't have the booster, they couldn't go. So he had the booster. And he said he never felt well since that booster. His wife developed arthritis for the first time in her life after the booster. He then started to feel very unwell with muscle pains, etc., had a severe back. He had to get scanned. His spine and pelvis were riddled, and they were riddled with melanoma, and he had the best treatment he could possibly have had. He had the latest immunotherapy. He had Ipi-Nivo. He had Zometa and all the other things for the bone. And he was dead within weeks. This is the first turbo cancer I have ever seen like that for decades.
Because how long had he been in remission, Gus?
Pardon?
How long had he been in remission under control?
About 18 months. And he had quite a thin cancer, so I never expected him to relapse. Never, ever expected. And he was, that's the other thing, this guy was fit. I mean, he was really, really fit. He's one of the best skiers I've ever skied with. And, you know, he was as strong as an ox. And to me, this was just a personal tragedy. And I realized as then I interviewed his wife, who got this severe arthritis, for which she's still on anti-TNF medication 2 years later, nearly. I mean, the amount of damage the booster vaccines have caused. That's what I'm focusing on. I mean, the first two did enough damage with clotting and strokes and God knows what else. But yep, it's the boosters with cancer that I've become focused on. And I think it's an absolute crime and negligence to say you should have a booster.
Angus, yes? Why are these tumors so aggressive? Do you think it's the profound immune suppression together with the IgG4 switch? Or is there some other reason?
Well, those two are enough to allow for the tumours just to relapse. But these really aggressive ones, it does suggest there's something else driving them. And we do know that spike protein can integrate. And there are reports that it can bind to suppressor genes, P53, MSH3, etc. And, you know, and what else it could be interfering with. And we know from Ryan Cole that that some of these metastatic tumors actually have the spike protein from the vaccine, because you cannot confuse the two, because it's a really artificial spike protein messenger RNA for the vaccine. If it was natural, it wouldn't be there, because it would have been dissolved in 20 seconds, like all RNA should be. So, it's multifactorial, I think.
Do you think another component is this DNA plasmid with these promoter sequences could be driving this?
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's clearly another one. The other one is the promoter sequence. SV40 is a very well-known, driver of this. And, how many other things are there we don't know about that it's unleashed?
Have you seen this? We use the term turbo. It's probably not... has a clear definition, but you use the term just aggressive cancers. Mm. Now that you've seen so many of these, does that relate to your prior experience, just how fast these things are moving and how aggressive they are? I mean, have you had cases similar, or this is really unprecedented?
Previously, before COVID came along, you would occasionally get them. Yes, they did exist, particularly colorectal cancer in young patients. Some of those have presented previously very aggressive. Now the number of young people with colorectal cancer is exploding, and they are very much turbo cancers. It's more evident really than in the melanoma. And I've had another case I knew very well, a lymphoma in remission for years, who had to have the booster to go overseas for his son's wedding. Whilst celebrating the wedding, at the end he didn't feel that well, had to go back home, had a relapse of his lymphoma. Remember, he just had a booster to go for this traveling, so it was within a few weeks. And what was fascinating was that I had warned his wife my suspicions about this, that, and the other. And I said, for Christ's sake, don't let them give him another COVID vaccine because he's at risk. And she gave back to me and she said, it's very interesting that when the guy took him on board, the oncologist, he said the same as you, he must not have any more vaccines.
Wow.
I said, really? And you hadn't even primed or told him.
Interesting. So other oncologists have reckoned, they're not as public, they haven't come out in public, but this was just a standard oncologist that he contacted and he gave the same advice.
Yeah, exactly. And he was, this friend lived in California, so this is a US lymphoma specialist. Mm.
But Angus, what you're saying is it seems not that it doesn't follow the first or second shot, but mostly after the boosters. Would that be correct?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, all sorts of other things happen after the first and second, but not this cancer association, which
it's
is
like it's really... like a triple hit, Gus, because you did mention heart attacks, strokes. I mean, all the terrible tragedies, the sudden deaths that we're seeing, particularly in that first year, weeks to months, that first year after the first one or two shots. But then this other catastrophe looms after the boosters, which is now cancers are exploding.
Exactly. Mm.
So the next question is, so many people have been boosted. What do you think the delay is between the booster and developing cancer? So, someone who's been boosted, how long is their risk of getting cancer? Because we know, like with myocarditis, it's usually within the first 7 days. So the question is, after the booster, how long do you think the risk of getting cancer persists?
Well, the three cases I know who are very close to me, I mentioned two of them, there's another one, it was all within about 6 weeks after the booster. But if that's never going to be, if you don't get it by 6 weeks, you're not going to get it, because the booster may then start integrating. It may start inhibiting suppressor gene function. That could take 2-3 many, many years. That's my big concern.
Well, the other thing, Gus, is that I think the cases you just presented all had a history of cancer and these were relapses. So for primary cancers developing, that could be longer time frame between.
That is my fear. I mean, it's a lot of these inductions, all the viruses take a long time. You know, the hepatitis B, HPV, they take years. They're not months or weeks like we've seen. So my real worry is that we've primed a large amount of the population that they're going to be more susceptible to cancer quicker. Or if they were going to get cancer, we'll be bringing it forward. I mean, so it's a significant fear, is that it's not just the T-cell suppression and the IgG. It could actually be an integrating pattern, which would then take a lot longer.
So what do you think are the main cancers that are being associated with the vaccine? So you mentioned melanoma, you mentioned colorectal. I mean, what about breast and lung and other cancers?
Well, certainly there seems to be excess of kidney cancer. People have noticed that. And certainly leukemia lymphomas. In fact, I was able to on my fingers, I'm up to 8 people I know, not even patients, nothing to do with hospital or patients, who have had leukemias or lymphomas diagnosed after having the booster. I mean, it's quite incredible. 4 of them worked at one place of work, institution. Wow. And what surprised me the most is that when I met one of these people who told me that they were suffering from nodes in the neck, and they'd been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I said, I was really quite silly. I was trying to be empathetic. And I said, goodness me, what on earth caused that when you're so well? And she said, oh, my oncologist said it's due to the vaccine. She's got several patients. I said, just like that. So people know it's out there. But when I try to report it, when I try to report it, I'm told it's just anecdote and coincidence, and I mustn't frighten the patients.
Well, Gus, this was my question to you, and I meant to say it in the introduction, but, you know, we spoke together at Andrew Bridgen's Parliament meeting, and your talk there was so powerful, and especially the way you went through some of the science and the immunology, explaining what some of these things that we're seeing. But also, I know of your work in public. I mean, you've been very publicly outspoken, trying to warn the world, just like Paul and I do. I do a lot of stuff around the vaccines, more on the chronic syndromes as well as the sudden deaths. But what is the state of the data right now? Because I know Ed Dowd has done incredible work showing the uptick in cancers in the, because the UK data is better than US. Here we have a gentleman named the Ethical Skeptic, who's a systems analyst, statistician. Incredible work showing, I was just reading something this morning, that $26 billion in excess cancer treatment cost for 2024. $26 billion is what it's looking like for 2024. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the data is now coming out. Is that being published? Is that being, or is it like everything else just being ignored and dismissed?
Well, it's been accepted that we have a cancer problem, and we've got an excess death problem. And the people that be, when they're challenged with it, just said, well, this is just the consequences of an aging population, which, you know, is partly true. It's partly true, but it's way in excess of what we should have. That's the case. And it's a real public health thing in the UK. Our healthcare system, which they keep boasting about being very good, cannot cope with the aging population, even though they've been warned about it for about 50 years, 40, you know, they know it's coming along. And now they cannot cope with the sudden increase in the excess cancers. They used to boast that you were diagnosed and started treatment within 2 weeks of a cancer diagnosis. That was put in place in the in the 90s. Now you're extremely lucky to get a telephone appointment with a GP within 2 weeks, let alone anything else. So by the time you start the treatment, it's way in excess of 60 odd weeks. That alone is going to kill lots of people, because the earlier you treat cancer, the more curable it is.
And, you know, Gus, I mean, this is before. So I'm a pulmonologist, and I did a lot of lung cancer work because I did a lot of procedures, biopsies. And I know that 2 week, you know, metric that we were always trying to hit. It was nearly impossible in lung cancer because you had to get, you know, procedure, diagnosis, pathology. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we tried. I'll just give you some granular kind of frontline of it, but I've been writing, I write a Substack, and I did a whole series on reports from the front lines. And I have this one nurse at a major academic medical center in the Midwest. And she told me that what's happening in cancer at this cancer center is absolutely astounding. Like, the oncologists are applying for infusion space in their offices because the infusion suites are totally booked out. ORs are booked out for cancer operations. Yep. She's able to look at like the schedules of some oncologists. She said this one morning for this one neuro-oncologist, six new glioblastomas in one day on a Monday. And quite a few of them were young. And so, I mean, she paints this really devastating picture. And when you hear about the $26 billion, and so I'm just kind of emphasizing what you say, you know, that idea of getting people diagnosed and treated quickly with this huge surge. And the system's already cracking, and I think a lot of people fleeing. I don't know what it's like in the UK, but I hear a lot of nurses are leaving, doctors are retiring. I mean, it really isn't just another calamity.
It is, without a doubt. I mean, I sent a patient who I was suspected whether his prostate cancer was grumbling active, and I sent him to a private hospital because he was fully insured here. So he went there to get his scan and everything done quickly. And he came back and he told me that the nurse who's in charge of the triage and say, oh, you just need your blood in the scan, we'll send it back to your doctor. She said they'd never seen so many young people who had developed explosive prostate cancer. Now, I was unaware of that till my patient reported that back to me.
Right.
So, Angus, is the treatment of these turbo or aggressive tumors different from you know, a regular prostate cancer? Is their approach different, or do you just treat them the same?
Yeah, and just I want to add to that question, Paul. Not only that question, Gus, but I think I know the answer. Are they harder to treat? Are they more resistant to standard treatment? Or like Paul said, do you have to do something differently?
Well, they're all treated the same way because we don't know what different thing to do, for a start. And as I said, in the case of my very good friend who developed melanoma, that treatment he got should have had an 80% chance of totally curing all his tumour, or at the very least reducing it and making it stable. That's about 95%. That's how good the treatment is. He might as well not have had the treatment. Mm. That's how explosive his cancer was.
You're citing.
Can I ask you something? Sorry to interrupt, Pierre. So, since you know a lot of this is immune suppression, do you think that boosting the immune system with something, BCG or something, may help with T cell function and immune surveillance, which would not be standard of care, you know, normally?
Mm. That's a fantastic question. We obviously treated the melanoma patients with this hyperimmune therapy, but it's a checkpoint inhibitor. And if your innate immune system has been switched off, then it does not work as well. And one of my colleagues, I was able to persuade to do a study by giving, I've worked on a thing called IMM-101. It's a heat-killed mycobacteria. It was developed from heat-killed mycobacterium vaccae, which was developed by TB colleagues in an effort to get a better BCG, because the BCG is live attenuated, but actually the heat-killed mycobacteria are much better. They explode the innate immune response, so they're very good. So I do agree with you. If I had free access to that, that's what I'd do. When we did a trial, where we primed with this agent before giving a checkpoint inhibitor, nivolumab, in patients with stage 4 cancer. The response rate was twice as good, and the side effects were even less. Wow. So every other combination in checkpoints means you get better response rates, but the side effect becomes so bad that the majority of patients can't have the full treatment because they suffer really long-term side effects, colitis, pneumonitis, hepatitis. None of these patients got these side effects. And one of the things, if you boost the innate immune response, it seems to damp down unnecessary inflammatory responses. So, I mean, ideally, I would. What I struggle is that we haven't got that agent over the line yet due to there were real big hiccups in basically company-related, small company, underfunded, the usual thing, very good trials, and the regulators say, oh, it needs a bigger trial. I would say, why the hell do you need a bigger trial when you show a highly significant benefit in a malignant disease and with no side effect issues whatsoever, and it's the same agent you've done hundreds of patients in cancer, thousands in TB, and there's no side effect issue? And of course I point out this is a very rich irony, because they didn't seem to worry about side effects with the COVID vaccines.
So can I ask you, just regular BCG, do you think there would be of any benefit?
One regular BCG is certainly, I believe, of benefit, but you can only have the one. It's otherwise it induces an inflammatory response, but a single, which is why the heat killed approach was followed, because with cancer it's so quick to turn off the immune response, you need repeated stimulation, and you can't do that with BCG. It's interesting, we mentioned about its use previously in bladder cancer, but that's an inflammatory response it induces. It's what you want. But when you use it systemically, you're after an innate T-cell response, not an inflammatory response, which is why I spent so much time focusing on these heat-killed ones, because you can keep giving it, and if the cancer turns off the immune response, you give it again, and you never get an inflammatory response. In fact, it dampens the inflammatory response. So it's working like a real immune modulator, which is why I'm so keen on it.
So, Pierre, I'm interrupting all the time.
That's okay.
So what do you think about the use of repurposed drugs? So there are a whole bunch of, you know, drugs such as vitamin D, metformin, metbendazole, ivermectin, which seem to have some, you know, any cancer effect. Do you think it has a role in these patients?
What, repurposed drugs in cancer patients or in COVID patients?
Cancer patients.
Without doubt, I do. I mean, you mentioned vitamin D as a drug. I mean, I've been a big campaigner for vitamin D for years, because when we did our early cancer immunotherapy studies, I was staggered that some patients had miraculous responses. I mean, the tumors disappeared in front of your eyes, but in the majority, nothing happened. So we started to look why. And without going into the very interesting history of this, I'll tell you the results. When we could measure the vitamin D, it was obvious. The only people responded were the only people with normal vitamin D. So we started supplementing with vitamin D, and our response rate went up to the point where I would never now treat anybody with cancer until I've got their vitamin D level into a nice, high, healthy level, above 100, not 50, as they say over here. That's the first thing. Now, other drugs, yes, I do believe they're very, very important. Anti-inflammatories are very, very important, because inflammation, chronic inflammation drives cancer. So you must have some form of anti-inflammatory. We know from models, even aspirin will improve the outcome of other standard treatments in cancer patients, and particularly to immunotherapy. So I, again, this is a very long story, and I don't have time to tell you, but as most things that dawn on me, it's because I listen and look at the patient, not the textbooks, not the FDA, not Tony Fauci, or not any of the government. Low-dose naltrexone came into my attention because of a patient doing so incredibly well on it. I said, why did you take it? Where did you get it? And unlike my colleagues who said, it's not licensed, it's not approved, it's dangerous, patients must stop it, I started researching it. And I found that it actually inhibits TLR9. And TLR9 is a very important inflammatory pathway, which when you stimulate produces IL-6. Well, I've been around long enough to remember IL-6 being discovered. It was called cancer growth factor. And I said, here we've got a common old garden drug that switches it off. Big pharma will make you antibodies to IL-6 when it's too late. But here you've got a repurposed drug that will switch off the supply of IL-6 right at the beginning. So I basically put nearly all my patients now as well on the low-dose naltrexone, which we've also shown sensitizes tumor cells So they're much more likely to enter into apoptosis when exposed to chemo than if they had not been pre-treated with low-dose naltrexone. And I believe I talked to Ryan Cole, you mean there are a group of us who are very interested in using low-dose naltrexone for long COVID, which again is defined by IL-6. And there's papers there showing the higher the IL-6 when you're ill, the greater the chance of long COVID if you recover.
Well, Gus, I'll just mention in my practice, I specialize in long COVID and long vax. Long vax is, by the way, much more common than long COVID. I mean, 70%
totally
of my
patients. Yeah. Totally agree.
100%. And low-dose naltrexone is absolute standard foundational therapy that we use in our patients.
Fantastic. I mean,
first-line therapy, yeah. I would say about 70% have a demonstrable clinical response to it.
Yeah.
So I have one more question. Do you think that these repurposed drugs work additively or synergistically together as adjunctive therapy? So, for example, vitamin D plus low-dose naltrexone plus mabenazole all together, because they act on different pathways.
Yes, they do. I agree. And I try and get, as I said, all my patients of vitamin D, as many as possible when it's relevant for the low-dose naltrexone. The IMM, if I can get them, although I can only do it in trials at the moment, and I'm desperate to push that available. If I had my way, every cancer patient I saw, I would correct the vitamin D, which I do. I would give them the IMM program to restore their innate immune response. I put them on low-dose naltrexone to reduce the background inflammation, which fuels the tumor growth. And then I'd stage them, send them off for staging, and then work out what treatment they needed, chemo, radiotherapy, or surgery. This what I'm talking about resets the damage done by the cancer. And I think one of my really best cancer papers ever was one when I had we had a big colorectal practice in my hospital, and one of the registrars came to me and said, I'm really fascinated about the immune suppression in melanoma when you measure. Can you do that in colorectal patients? And I said, yes, but I have to get the specimen. He said, I'd like to do it as a research project. I said, that's fantastic. So he brings along the blood from all these patients who are having their colon cancer resected, and their Jukes A and B, occasionally C, and we measure it. And then 1 month later, when they've recovered and they're out of the hospital, they come back for the trial. We measure their immune system again, just in their bloods. We're looking for their T-cell responsiveness, gamma interferon, etc. They're all back in the normal range. So the only conclusion is those tiny tumors, Jukes A and B, have caused global systemic suppression in these patients. And it was so overbearing that when you remove these tiny tumors, boom, the immune system recovers. So it was being suppressed. So mm-hmm. I thought this was really good background baseline, saying that, well, a lot of my patients, I can't just cut it out. I can reduce the load, but it's still there. So I need to boost that immune response artificially. And that's when we started using the heat kill mycobacterium. And I was using it in a wide variety of cancers. It's been in a lot of tumor types. The most convincing is we primed with IMM before gemcitabine and with gemcitabine versus gemcitabine in metastatic pancreatic cancer. And we got a highly statistical increase in overall survival, and even more importantly, in pancreatic cancer, progression-free survival. That's never really been properly documented. Well, in spite of that, they should have given us approval for that, but they wanted a bigger trial, which the company couldn't afford. So much useful stuff is actually being prevented by what actually is all the problems that have caused we've had to suffer from HIV and COVID, in which we're all issued. If I could say one more thing, though, we're talking about repurposed drugs, and I've got a list in which we've looked at, and one of the ones we're doing a lot of work in at the moment, and I have to credit you, Pierre. I don't know if you can see this.
Oh, I've seen that book before.
Yeah, Invermectin. we're very there's a significant anti-cancer activity of that drug, which we're trying to dissect. I mean, I'm a proper scientist, I would like to think, unlike Tony Fauci. And so we actually do experiments and look at what we can extrapolate from there. And that's how we knew low-dose naltrexone is, whereas, I mean, it really is a proper anti-cancer drug. We're doing this with ivermectin at the moment.
How are you studying that, Gus? Are you doing a proper trial, like with controls or observational or what?
This at the moment is lab-based.
Oh, you're doing basic science work.
Basically, I want a justification to go in to use it. They always want that before they let you do a clinical trial. Right. Anecdotally, there's a lot of benefit for people who get ivermectin. I mean, a lot of my patients have gone out and they managed to find a source. And so I've been very interested. I'm very interested whether there's a significant anti-cancer activity ivermectin, and whether that activity is alone or in combination. So often, the best is in combinations.
Right. Yeah. Well, we have, Paul, I mean, we're now aware of increasing numbers of clinical case reports, like not formally published, but clinical anecdotes of patients with tremendous responses. And in some cases, Paul, I think it's just ivermectin, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, Pierre, we're getting towards the top of the hour. Maybe we can summarize and get Dr. Dautish to give some final thoughts.
Well, my final thoughts, I mean, I really now think that the COVID vaccine program has been the biggest disaster ever inflicted on humanity in my lifetime.
Yes.
And the fact that nobody has stopped it when there's been so many red flags, so many yellow cards, so many VAERS, is a negligence on a scale which it is criminal. Actually, it really is criminal. So many people have been killed by the vaccines, and yet the leading sayers say this vaccine has saved millions of lives. We get this all, but there is no evidence for that whatsoever. So I now think, for what I said, my fear is all these vaccinated people are primed to increase their chances of getting cancer. It's like you put the whole population on 60 cigarettes a day for life. I mean, it's that type of priming. And so I think that one of our most important issues is, can we detoxify that spike protein? And I think that that is our biggest mission, is to try and do that and show it scientifically, so you can get the circulating cells or a biopsy tissue from vessels or something, do a detoxification regimen, and do you reduce it, get rid of it, the way we do with circulating tumor cells. And of the things that I think are most important, it's vitamin D, low-dose naltrexone, ivermectin, and there are others out there. Peter McCullough's very keen on natokinase, which I haven't looked at, I must say. N-acetylcysteine is another one that comes up when you scour all those things that might be beneficial, and probably many more. But I personally think that is the most pressing thing of a healthcare authority, is not signing up to the WHO to prepare for the next pandemic, disease X, which I am afraid, as you know, I was the first, my friend Sorensen, to Birger Sorensen, to call out that this virus came from the lab 100%. It's not even debatable. There were six inserts in that sequence. And why did nobody discuss it? They just told us to be quiet. These six inserts gave the receptor binding region. And remember, I was told, I was dismissed by my chief medical officer as just a clinician. I did all this work on HIV receptor. I know what I'm talking about. This receptor binding region of COVID had the highest charge ever in coronaviruses. It was there to make it act like a fridge magnet. So it came anywhere near a cell, it snapped onto it. It doesn't just use the ACE receptor, as everybody says. It latches onto alternative receptors. And two of them we were able to pick up. They're the receptors you use for taste and smell, which happens to go when you get infected. It was all there, but we were ignored, dismissed. Nobody would publish it. We were rejected, not in the public interest at all. And in that paper, which we had to publish under disguise, we actually pointed out 80% of the spike protein had homology to humans. And in the case of platelet factor 4 and myelin, it was virtually 100%. So he said, use the whole spike protein, then you're going to get big clotting problems, neurological problems. But unfortunately, we're blown away when 150 people published in Nature that that was the way to make a COVID vaccine. You couldn't make it up.
Wow. Wow. Well, Gus, thanks for your brilliance and your expertise and sharing your insights, and particularly around the cancers. You know, we are doing, we're forming a group of a number of practitioners who do adjunctive cancer care, where we're using repurposed drugs. And we're doing an observational study. So we're kind of doing more clinical work. So be interested to keep in touch going forward. We can share some of our findings.
I would very much love to. I have no clinical exposure to long COVID other than people who have come for a second opinion about things. So I found it very difficult to influence clinical trials. But I am probably in a good position to say, if you've got good data, you're doing a good trial, to get people here to take notice and to join in. So that's good. If I could just end up doing a plug for that book, because Death of Science, there, as you can see, and we have some very good contributors to it. But essentially, I was asked to write about the lockdown, the science behind the lockdown and everything. And it was on off with the publisher. And a friend of mine saw it and he said, oh, this really needs expanding. There's much more to this. You know, everything's being clamped down. And he said, can I contribute and write? So I said, go away, you know, go ahead, you know, write the chapters. And when we started to put it together, I said, you do realize that what we've documented is the death of science as we know it. And he said, great title. And he said, that's what we're going to use. But actually, going back through the history, I think the death of science started in the AIDS epidemic. In the HIV epidemic.
You know, Gus, we could probably do another hour on this topic, because this is the thing that like exploded my brain in COVID. And even Paul's. I mean, when we started, I don't think we knew just how deep the scope and the scale of the corruption and control of science and how far back it's gone. But that's been a huge insight for many of us. And, you know, you called your book Death of Science. I always say, like in interviews and stuff, I'm estranged. I don't even recognize, you know, what I thought was science. It's been really transformative, and not in a good way, maybe in a good way, because knowledge is always good. It helps you navigate more correctly. So
Angus, Pierre and I want to thank you. It's been an absolute delight. And you know what? You know, HIV is such an interesting topic because we were misled. Maybe we can bring you back and talk about HIV.
I think all the corruption really took off with HIV, but it spread to the cancer. This idea, you mentioned it in your book, Pierre, and I've become very cynical of it. Fauci's obsession with randomized controlled trials.
Yep.
The only control is if he's in control, so he can modify it so he gets the answer out of it he wants. And I think I'm not the first person to point that out, but it screams aloud and it all started with HIV and AZT. And I also, you know, I'm a great critic now. I've worked with Fauci and been with him in many things since 1984. And I remember him promising everybody in Washington in 1984 that his institute would produce a vaccine in 18 months. That's 40 years ago. We still don't have one. And they've tried all sorts of ones. And Berger and I actually have a vaccine that works very well because we don't use the envelope. But they've consistently had our applications tramped by the Gates Foundation, the NIH, all basically said, on the grounds, we have a very good one in trial. We don't need a plan B. Oh, well, there's three big global vaccine trials have all failed. And they've failed because they've used the envelope of the virus, which is 3,000 epitopes on it. If you throw 3,000 epitopes at an immune response, it will select ones at random, and you can guarantee it will miss the Achilles heel. So the only thing to do is select the Achilles heel, those part of the virus that whatever variant you might evolve into, if you don't have that epitope, the virus will collapse. And, you know, that was the vaccine that we predicted would work for COVID. And they wouldn't take any notice of us, which is, that I must say, is the most frustrating thing in my career, because we've been right about many, many things, and yet no one takes any notice.
Yeah.
So, Angus, we just want to thank you. It's been a pleasure and delight having you on. And, you know, we would welcome you back again. So we
definitely got to bring you back.
Okay, well, I'd love to. I'd love to.
Thank you, Hank.
Got great respect for everything you've been doing too. Really have.
Thanks, Gus. Thank you.
Wow. Oh, boy. We do have to have him back. All right, gentlemen. We're almost at the top of the hour. Can you go to 8:15?
Yeah, we can go a bit. I just want to mention, you know, that Dr. Baldish is really highly respected. He's a full professor, and, you know, he's a leading expert in his field. And so that was really, he's just such a wealth of knowledge. I just thought I would mention that. So, yeah, let's take a few questions.
Paul, you know, we did that interview this morning, and I listened to every word again. I was, like, completely captivated. I love listening to that guy. Anyway, go ahead, Betsy.
It was the second time for me, too. I listened to it after we got it, and boy, oh, boy, I learned a lot. All right, so first off, Robin Brownlee says, okay, what is the latest information regarding fenbendazole and cancer? I'm a nurse. I would like to hear about treatments that are outside the box. Can you help on that one?
Yeah, let me take that one. So we prefer mebendazole. Fenbendazole is in the same class as fenbendazole. Acts on multiple different pathways, including cell division. We prefer the use of mebendazole because it's approved, it's FDA approved for use in humans. Fenbendazole, while people use it and get good results, is approved for veterinary medicine. So we can't directly approve it. But mebendazole is what we recommend. And in fact, there are compounding companies, particularly in India, where you can get mebendazole for about 27 cents a tablet. So I think that's the best answer we have. You know, if people want to use fenbendazole, you know, that's their choice, but it's not something we can recommend. Would you agree with that, Pierre?
Yeah, well, Paul, you made the important point, right? So the reason why fenben, right, is so popular on whatever, social media, the internet, certainly it has efficacy, but access of mebendazole in the United States, the FDA-approved product, is I think it's the hundreds of dollars for it. I can't remember. It's just insanely expensive. But you just pointed out, you go to India, like, what is it?
All-day pharmacy or something.
All-day chemist or something. That's one. And then there are certain compounders in the U.S. which provide it for very affordable prices, like $2 a pill. So, you know, that's what I use. But yes, in general, we would recommend you get a source to affordable mebendazole, and India would probably be the best choice.
Okay. Number two, we have from Michael C., who says, what supplements should one take if they decide to have chemo for cancer? What supplements should they avoid while having chemo treatments?
Okay, let me answer that. So I would say vitamin D, definitely, melatonin, probably curcumin are really important. The things you actually want to avoid, surprisingly, if you're getting chemo, is antioxidant therapy, because chemotherapy works by causing oxidant injury to DNA. So if you're taking vitamin C, if you're taking NAC, if you're taking coenzyme Q, it actually diminishes the efficacy of chemotherapy. So that's a good question. There are some supplements that will enhance the efficacy of chemo, particularly vitamin D, melatonin, metformin, and there are others that will actually limit the efficacy. So one should really not take antioxidants with chemotherapy.
But Paul, talk about, you mentioned vitamin C, you talk about IV or oral?
So oral.
But right.
So it's used, yes, it's used differently. It's a very good question, Dr. Corey.
Thank you.
It's a really interesting thing that if you take low dose or oral vitamin C, it acts as an antioxidant. But if you use massive doses intravenously, you know, 50 to 75 grams, paradoxically, the vitamin C acts as a prooxidant. It results in production of hydrogen peroxide. So it actually enhances the efficacy of chemotherapy. So there are many oncologists who will use intravenous high-dose vitamin C during chemotherapy. That's a very important distinction there, Dr. Corey.
Thank you, Paul.
Good to know. Now, a question from Laura Chamberlain. Says, hey, doctors, is there a place for nicotine patches in your alternative cancer protocol?
So not that I know of. I know nicotine patches have been used in long COVID or long vax because the spike protein interferes with the nicotinic receptor and you have vagus nerve dysfunction. So it's a good question. I don't know. I
don't know of any relation to cancer therapy. I think that's a different topic. They may have been conflating the two. We are interested in the role of nicotine in long vax, long COVID, but not in cancer.
Okay. Question from a viewer. Is Gardasil still safe and effective? Should teenagers be given Gardasil?
Paul, can I take that one?
You take that, Pierre.
The first part of the question was, is Gardasil still safe and effective? Can we just be clear that of the most dangerous vaccines in history, COVID is in a class of itself, and I would say number two is Gardasil. Period, end of story. It's never been safe or effective and should not be used. It should have been taken off the market years ago. It's so much of the childhood vaccines are a fraud built on myths and corrupted data. Can we just get off the childhood vaccine thing? But I will just say Gardasil, zero. Never would I give anybody Gardasil or recommend Gardasil to anyone.
Here's a long question from a doctor in Japan, from Dr. Katsuhiko Fukuda in Japan. The doctor says, in Japan, in the midst of the seventh booster dose of the mRNA vaccine, another COVID-19 infectious wave is spreading, and the number of so-called multisystemic turbocarcinomas continues to increase. There is concern that the world's most commonly administered dose of molnupiravir may amplify mutant strains caused by the Replicon vaccine, which has begun to be administered and has become a new problem in Japan, along with cancer from DNA gene contamination of the mRNA vaccine. Are there any criteria that can clearly diagnose turbo cancer after vaccination?
So that's a good question. There aren't specific tumor markers we know of that can separate a turbo cancer from a regular cancer, but many oncologists, if they actually do a biopsy or look at the specimen, can find spike protein within the tumor. And we know that many tumor, you know, in vitro experiments, that spike protein binds to the surface of cancer cells. So probably the best way of distinguishing, you know, regular cancer from turbo cancer is to find spike protein within the tumor. The other thing, and Pierre can maybe answer, is, and I don't know, is if one looks at anti-spike antibodies, it's possible that these patients have high levels. I don't know.
That's a good point you just made, but let me go back to the original question. To me, this term that is turbo cancer, that's a clinical diagnosis, and we don't have clear criteria. Like if you saw in the interview with Gus, you know, I asked him, like, you know, I kind of just said we haven't defined what turbo cancer is. It's essentially, it's an aggressive cancer that progresses rapidly and that causes, you know, rapidly diminishing function or symptoms in a rapid fashion. That's a clinical thing. So there's no test for turbo cancer. That's a clinical one. But what Paul said is interesting. It's more like, you know, is there a way to assess the role of the spike protein in those cancers? And Paul, remind me, We have had a few cases where we sent biopsy samples to Ryan Cole and he stained for spike and he found a lot of spike protein in the cancers. And so that's a different question. It's, the second question would be like, how can you tell if the spike protein is, you know, contributing or implicated in that cancer? And there you would need to do a biopsy, secondary stains for spike protein. But very few people are doing that. I mean, that's another one of the massive frauds in COVID is that no one is staining for spike protein. I mean, Arnie Burkhart in Germany did it. Sutri Bhakti did it. But very few people have done it. Ryan Cole is trying to do it. But in general, they're not looking for spikes. So they don't actually know what's causing all these illnesses.
There's a question from Ari Goldberg who says, which is the bigger contributor to the cancers, the spike protein in the mRNA vaccines or the plasma DNA contamination from the manufacturing process?
I mean, that's clear. We don't know the answer. I mean, that was covered with the interview with Gus. I mean, Gus gave several different mechanisms for why cancers are exploding. DNA plasma contamination with the promoter sequences in that, the immunosuppression, the attacks on the tumor suppressor genes that we have. I mean, it's a whole. I mean, I think it would be a really amazing field of study, but I actually don't think that at the same time. Meaning, why study it? Just stop the vaccines. We have so many glaring signals of unprecedented harm from these vaccines. I don't think we should study it anymore. Just stop them.
Ray Echeves asks, do we now have records of success with ivermectin treatment for post-vax cancer or turbo cancer?
Case anecdotes, case reports. We presented one at our conference 2 weeks ago, you know, an incredible end-stage prostate cancer patient who had, you know, not been offered any more treatment and went into remission on ivermectin. I mean, they're all sort of case series anecdotes. Not all of them are published. But I hope as we go on that we're going to have more published literature.
Yeah. What is interesting, you know, speaking to clinicians across the world is many clinicians are actually using ivermectin to treat cancer. They're not talking about it. They're not advertising it. But it seems to be quite a common practice. And many of them are reporting good results.
So hey, Paul, Gus said that his patients are doing it. Like a lot of his patients are doing it on their own. So
yeah, so patients are pretty smart. They're gonna do research and do what they need to do. You know, so the problem is we don't have big observational studies. So it's difficult.
We're going to,
but it will take time. And as he said, doing a randomized controlled trial is such a stupid idea, which is what the ivory tower will suggest. But, you know, it's such a safe drug, and it seems to work very effectively. You know, I was in communication with a physician in the Philippines who, you're not going to believe it, was using 5 milligrams per kilogram of ivermectin, which is a massive dose. So we don't know the optimal dose, but we think a dose of 12 to 18 milligrams would probably be okay.
And Paul, let's be clear. You know, we talk about our observational study. I think, you know, our observational study will ultimately, if it's positive and we show really important impacts, it's simply going to demonstrate the efficacy of repurposed medicines in combination. I mean, we're really not doing an ivermectin study. Those of us, the practices that are involved in this study, we're using combinations. I would say my practice and my protocol, I've seen several patients now and I've put them on protocol. I'm using, like Paul said in his cancer document, I'm using a really wide variety of combinations. Kathleen Ruddy is using a smaller subset of 3 or 4, but like we're not testing single repurposed medicines against cancer. I think the outcome of our study will show, hopefully, the positive impact of combination repurposed kind of metabolic mechanisms at treating cancer.
That was very good, Pierre.
Thank you.
Very good. I hope to get a few more in here. Karen Harmon asks, What's the connection between breast cancer and EBV, Epstein-Barr virus? Almost all of us with breast cancer have had EBV, so there must be a trigger that goes with EBV to cause breast cancer.
It sounds like a question for Angus.
Yeah, or Dr. Reddy. So Dr. Reddy has been looking at a breast cancer virus, which I don't think is EBV, so it's not a question Pierre or myself can answer.
Oh, well, we'll bring them back. Okay. From Pat Metcalf, have you heard of people getting ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, due to the COVID vaccine?
Of course. I mean, I have three patients in my practice. One of them just died 2 weeks ago of ALS. I mean, it all started subsequent to the vaccines. I tried everything with those patients that I usually do with all of my post vaccine injury patients, and nothing worked, unfortunately, and they succumbed. But yeah, now we all, I mean, there's plenty of examples of ALS from the vaccine.
How frustrating.
So stunningly, Betsy, you name a disease, the COVID vaccine can cause it. It's just the list of conditions associated with the vaccine goes on for 20 pages or more.
Yep.
There's probably not a single disease it doesn't cause.
Here's a question from someone who says, a friend got only one COVID shot in April of 21. Is there still the danger of spike proteins causing any harm? For how long do you have to expect the vax to produce spike protein?
Oh,
yeah, so let me try to take that one. So, you know, obviously one vaccine can cause harm. We know patients who've died after a single shot of the vaccine. In terms of the cardiac risk, in terms of atherosclerosis, microvascular disease, clotting, it may last for a year, up to a year after the vaccine. That's what we think.
But Paul, you answered the question. You answered a different question. I think the question was specifically about how long can people make spike protein after the vaccine. Paul answered how long the more acute, unfortunate, undesirable outcomes occur after the vaccine. The reason why I want to differentiate those two is in my research on shedding, to be honest, we really don't know how long. All of the work that I have seen on shedding, the worst study is where they found circulating vaccine-induced spike protein in the blood 187 days after vaccination. But you have to be clear, that is not the maximum. They stopped the study after 187 days. So we don't actually know the true limit to which vaccinated patients can produce spike protein. However, I want to be a little bit more positive. There's so much we don't know. We know from the Danish study that there was literally placebos being injected into arms. So not everyone vaccinated got, you know, functional modified mRNA injected that they then uptook and produced spike. Many of them probably had no effect. And so, like, you can't categorize the vaccinated as, like, being indefinitely producing spike. But the studies show that there are very, you know, at the worst, there are extremely long periods at which vaccinated can produce spike. But yeah. I don't think you can describe the whole population of vaccinated.
So Betsy, he asks a really good question. Probably the most important test we could develop is to be able to measure circulating spike in the blood. Then we would have an answer. So this should be a commercially available test that people can get. So they can measure, do they have spike in the blood? So that's really important from a scientific academic point of view, but it's also very important practically, because if you still have circulating spike, as Pierre says, a year after vaccine, then you want to do something about it. So it is probably the most important test we can develop. And it is the test that they don't want to do because they don't want us to know the answer.
Yep.
All right. We have try to get a couple more in here. This is a person, Ted Lee says, I was recently diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. It was an incidental finding when I had a CT due to an attack of diverticulitis. I've never received any of the COVID vaccines, but I did have a mild case of COVID in January 22, which was followed by almost certain bronchitis and an eventual diagnosis of bronchiectasis. I will be working with Dr. Kathleen Ruddy on a plan of treatment for my cancer. Do you think that there may be an association between my episode of COVID, the bronchiectasis, and the cancer?
So I would say that there's probably no relationship between the bronchiectasis and the cancer.
I agree.
There possibly is a relationship with having COVID. You know, patients with long COVID may be at increased risk. But I think, you know, he's made the right decision, you know, to go along with Dr. Ruddy and, you know, do what you can do. But obviously, to avoid any further vaccination and to take measures to prevent COVID, most importantly, if he gets COVID again, he should be treated early because it's the cumulative spike load which is harmful.
Last question is also a case study, but and maybe it'll be give this woman the book, your book. Nikki Berry says, my sister has just been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. A PET scan today found a lung mass that's likely the primary. She has a rapidly growing thyroid nodule and she's developing pleural effusion. They are suggesting that she has metastatic cancer. Can anything be done for her other than platinum-based chemo?
Well, you know what? I mean, the answer is that patients should seriously consider the use of repurposed drugs and metabolic therapy. Now, if the patient wants to take cisplatinum, that's fine, but there's no question of doubt that the use of adjunctive supplemental therapy will increase the response, improve quality of life, improve the chances of remission.
And so, Paul, primarily also the foundation would be starving the cancer, ketogenic diet, right?
Yes.
I mean, controlling the glucose and there are different approaches. Just doing platinum-based and radiation and that's been done for 70 years. And it's had some improvements, but there are different approaches. And I would suggest to that person that they read Paul's monograph.
Exactly. She needs the book. She needs your book. Yep. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. What fabulous information. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. Thank you so much. I have a few announcements, including the book, here to get people. And our new cancer study. Yes, indeedy. We have, okay, as you heard, Dr. Dalgleish is about his own research into repurposed drugs and cancer. And we're thrilled that he is going to work with us on our own study. As a reminder, we are gearing up for a new 5-year observational study to learn more, a lot more, about the role repurposed drugs can play in cancer treatment. There are 5 clinics involved, and to find out more, all you need to do is go to the link that is on the screen. Now then, about that book, if you haven't gotten yourself a copy of Dr. Merrick's monograph, Cancer Care, The Role of Repurposed Drugs and Metabolic Interventions in Treating Cancer, you can find it in several formats, as a download on our website, as a paperback or Kindle version on Amazon. Excuse me. This is such a vitally important topic and sadly one that affects nearly every family at some point or another. So please make sure to pass this along to friends and family. Now then, another way to learn and share important information is in our newly launched FLCCC Alliance forums. Here, without censorship, we can ask questions, share our experiences and expertise, learn, grow, and build community. FLCCC family-style community. And that is something we all need now more than ever. So make sure to visit flccc.net/forums to learn more and get started today. Many of you have been asking when the lectures from this month's Healthcare Revolution conference will be available. And the answer is, well, soon. Yeah. So please stay with us, stay tuned as we begin sharing these must-see lectures as part of our Education on Demand platform. As soon as they're all edited to get out the sneezes or the coughs or the or whatever sound obstructions or, you know, there's that stuff to just kind of clean them up to make sure they're really clear and easy for you to see. As soon as they become available, we will tell you. You'll hear about it. Now then, meanwhile, in one of the incredible speakers from our conference, he's been doing such good work, Dr. J.P. Salibi has a new episode of Whole Body Health out, and it's all about vasculitis, what it is, the common types, and the treatments, both mainstream and alternative. You can view now on our FLCCC Alliance Rumble and Odyssey channels or on our website at flccc.net/wholebodyhealth. And with that, let's bring up our wonderful nurses. Christina and Samantha have been on tonight. They've been busy as always, working behind the scenes to answer your questions. How has it been? Did you get a lot?
It's been very busy about cancer questions, Betsy.
Were you able to answer them, or do you have to call Dr. Dalgleish?
We had to call on the experts. We answered about half. There were other questions too. There's just so many questions, we couldn't get to them all. But if people want to email clinical@flccc.net, we can do our best to answer those questions.
And we thank you for being here and doing what you can and referring the others. So, you know, we're very grateful for the time that you put in here with our family. Thank you so much. And speaking of thanks, folks, you know, we have to, it's Valentine's Day. So it's a day specially made to show affection. And so let's take a moment to say how special you are to all of us. You know, we thank each and every one of you for joining us tonight and every week, for sharing this information with those you love and helping us do what we do and more of it. All the time. We are endlessly grateful. And with that, we will see you next week. Same time, same place. But before you click away, here's a lovely My Story from Sophie.
Hi, my name is Sophie. I am a junior at San Diego State University. My mom was a co-author of the book, The War on Ivermectin, with Dr. Pierre Corey. I initially was very anti this whole entire movement that the FLCCC has been doing. I was very scared of COVID. I was very into wanting the COVID-19 vaccine, which my mom was very against. I ended up not getting the vaccine. But going to school at San Diego State was very scary because everyone did have the vaccine. So I felt like I was kind of in this war between what my mom wanted, what I wanted, but wanting to do what was right. I just thought she was crazy. I thought she had really bad anxiety. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm going to have to do what I need to do, but it's going to put my health at risk, because the news and the information that I was fed was that people that weren't vaccinated were harming other people. So I go to school. One of the first days at school, I start feeling super sick. All my other friends are like, oh, like, are you vaccinated? And I was like, I'm not feeling good. I just tested positive for COVID. And I remember sitting in my room, bawling my eyes out, thinking, like, I'm gonna die, and it's because my mom didn't want me to get this vaccine. Now looking back at it, obviously I was very indoctrinated, and the news outlets had gotten to me, thinking that, like, I was putting other people at risk. I was putting myself at risk for listening to my mom. But I got through it. I took ivermectin, which is obviously what her book's about. Go get it. It's amazing. So I started taking ivermectin. I started feeling so much better, and I really had this whole epiphany of the idea that the government has really been hiding treatments for things. I read my mom's book, and honestly, like, literally the first 5 pages, I bawled my eyes out. I was like, chills all over my body, like, how crazy it is that we were so blinded, or I was so blinded for such a long time to everything that's going on. And it has just opened my mind to so many different things. And the FLCCC, like, being able to come to this conference has been one of the most amazing things ever. I've only really been to like one so far, but it's mind-blowing to see the impact that we can have if we are able to start opening our minds up, opening our eyes up to the fact that there are people that just want money and there are people that want solutions and answers, and they really care about patients. And I think that's what the FLCCC is doing, is making sure that the patients come first. And I'm so thankful to be here.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send it in to mystory@flccc.net.